Right then, the latecomers. You have to like pay a penalty coming in late. All right, so this is my last lecture. Death of the Author. So the lecture's really on two French thinkers, Roland Barthes and Michel Foucault, who you're reading in class, who wrote these theories about the death of the author. And the death of the author is, one of these very kind of well-known theories, it's often talked about. So what I'm going to do is outline a little bit, give you a bit of context as to why this theory is so popular and interesting. Then I'm going to talk about Barthes' relationship to the death of the author theories and why he's so important, why Barthes, let's just see, there we go. I think just from that image, for the sake of the podcast people, I'll put the PowerPoint on the online. Look at him. He's just so handsome and cool. You don't really need to read anyone else from this course after you've read him, I don't think. So I'll talk about Barthes, then I'll talk about a couple of his other related theories, his pleasure of the text theory, and then move into Foucault and then relate some of these ideas at the end to Howell. I'll probably sort of leave most of that for you to talk about in your own groups. So let me just start off by kind of thinking a little bit about what the death of the author theory is. Now, I don't know if you noticed, probably, maybe you did, that there was a new column in The Guardian that started in January 2010 on critical theory, sort of classics in critical theory, or something like that. And the first theory that they used was the death of the author theory. And so here's the journalist, typical kind of Guardian journalist. You know, most Guardian journalists all went to one kind of very conservative college in Oxford, apparently. Like 90% of them all went to Balliol, I think. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that they think this is radical now in 2010. It was written in, like, the 60s. But there you go. That's the Guardian and Oxford. That was, you know, for the sake of the podcast, I'm just joking, of course. I have chosen to inaugurate this series with a few considerations on the death of the author because of its truly iconic nature. It symbolizes the rise of what would come to be known as theory. Even if he never names them, Roland Barthes, like Proust before him, launches an attack on the traditional biography-based criticism which still dominated French academia in the 60s. The paradox, of course, is that this essay, with its symbolic slaying of the paternal author god, could lend itself to a textbook psychological reading, given that Barthes lost his own father before his first birthday. The death of the author theme itself takes on added meaning in hindsight when you consider that Barthes' critical career was, at least in part, a displacement activity to avoid writing the novel he dreamed of. Does any of this invalidate his theories? I'll let you be the judge of that. What an amazingly idiotic kind of reading of the death of the author. So it's anti-biography, but let's go straight into Barthes' biography and talk about how Barthes never wrote this novel that he was... nonsense. I mean, Barthes' work, his theoretical work, is it's poetic. It's poetry. He doesn't need to write a novel. He's written, you know, some of the best critical books of the entire 20th century. And that's really why we still think about the death of the author, not because of things like this, but because he looks like that. The death of the author theory was kind of, quite controversial in the 70s because of the fact that at the same time as death of the author theories were happening, you'd also got a kind of reclamation of women's writing by people, non-white people, queer theory, Marxist theory, and I suppose feminists and Marxists and post-colonialists, etc., said, you know, hang on, we've only just reclaimed all of these authors and now you're telling us that they're dead. And I mean, I think that is a kind of interesting debate that happens, you know, just after the death of the author theory was published. And, you know, I think since then there have been sort of hundreds of books written on the death of the author theory, where, you know, whether it's kind of useful or not. So we're kind of coming into it, I think, just to sort of show you the theory itself, to show you how it kind of has engendered this sort of massive debate about whether the death of the author is a sort of useful idea or not. And I think, you know, we might even say now we've abandoned it completely because there is a kind of return to biography in literary studies, I think. We don't call it biography now, we call it life writing. It makes it sound a bit more fashionable, I think. But I think that kind of idea of the death of the author theory, you know, whether it's still valid or not, you know, yes is the answer that I would give you. Mainly because I think, because it is initiated by Barthes' work, and I'm going to argue to you now that Barthes is the most influential philosopher of the 20th century, point blank, the most influential kind of theorist or philosopher. And I think because he is himself a creative writer, as he writes, you'll see when we look at his work, that it's not just straightforward prose. There's often kind of photographs in it, or it's written in a kind of diary form or an aphorism form. But also, we need to kind of think about the relationship between Barthes and Foucault, which I'll go on to talk about. And Foucault slightly kind of moves the death of the author debates into, I think, some of the areas that, you know, Marxists and feminists kind of contest. So Foucault is interested in the death of the author debate as a way into talking about questions of queerness, gender, etc. So let's start by talking about where Barthes' essay first appears. Well, it's firstly published in 1967, right at the end of the 60s, and later anthologized in a collection of his essays, a very important collection called Image, Music, Text. And critics argue that this essay, The Death of the Author, had a particular impact in France, particularly in France, because of France's kind of context, I think, in the 60s and 70s, where it's moving from a country that is very much led and shaped by Roman Catholicism in the 50s into a country that's shaped by left-wing politics. I mean, it's kind of an unusual shift that happens in France. Certainly doesn't happen here. Religion is neither as powerful, but nor does it kind of get displaced in the same way. Religion and politics are often kind of linked in Britain. So one of Barthes' arguments is that art and literature have become kind of mini gods to help people get through this transition where they're kind of rejecting Catholicism into politics. And of course, that means, I think, in a kind of Roman Catholic way, that authors become sort of mini gods, if you like, willing to preach in the place of priests. Just have another picture of Barthes looking handsome there. There we go, isn't he? Look at that tweed jacket. Now, Barthes, there's no reason for these photos. I just think he's very handsome. Barthes starts his essay, The Death of the Author, by quoting a sentence from a short story by Balzac. And now, this is important, not because I think you need to go and read the Balzac story, although you could, but because I think it's important the way in which Barthes uses a short story to kind of get into this question of the death of the author. And the novella is called Sarrazine, Sarrazine, S-A-R-R-A-S-I-N-E, which is a kind of early 19th century story by Balzac. And the story is an artist falls in love with a young castrato that he thinks is a woman. So the male artist falls in love with this guy that he thinks is a woman. And Barthes draws a parallel between the ambiguity of Sarrazine's feelings and the ambiguous identity of the speaker who describes the castrato of the essence of womanhood. So you've got this kind of artist narrator who is kind of constantly talking about this castrato figure as this essential woman, this essentially feminine being that kind of represents femininity. But as a reader, you kind of know that the castrato is male. But we don't really know very much about the speaker. We don't really know kind of why he is in love with this figure or why he is so obsessed with kind of thinking about this figure's gender. So we don't know who the speaker is. We don't know whether it's kind of associated with Balzac. I mean, Balzac does tend to kind of write these sort of stories that do implicate him as an author. They're often kind of coming from his own experiences, so we know that. But is it Balzac as an author, or is it Balzac as a man? I mean, you know, Barthes very interested in these sorts of distinctions. So after working through all these kind of different possibilities, Barthes kind of says that it's impossible to say who the opening sentence of this this novella should be attributed to, who's speaking it, who is kind of directing what love at whom. It's difficult to kind of know what's going on. And he has this very famous line where he says, that's in your anthologies, that this novella declares literature as, quote, a space where all identity is lost, beginning with the very identity of the body that writes. So the death of the author marks the birth of literature, we might say, defined in the essay as the invention of this voice, okay? So Barthes kind of talks about the voice of the author being lost and the invention of a new kind of voice happening, the voice of the text, the voice of literature. I think that's just a quick kind of aside on this use of the word text. I think that's something that you kind of maybe think about a bit in your first years. You know, you often sort of refer to books as books or novels or poems or whatever, you know, and then you get to university and everything is a text. And that's important for Barthes particularly. He wants you to reject the word, particularly the word work. He doesn't want you to say, oh, that poem by Wordsworth, Tintin Abbey, that work. He doesn't want to kind of see literature as a labor. He wants it to be a text that is kind of open for your interpretation rather than a labor of the author. So let's get into a little bit about like how Barthes starts to distinguish the author from the reader. Now, the modern writer, Barthes calls the modern writer the scriptor in your essay, the scriptor, can only mimic a gesture that's never kind of original. That's what he says in the essay. So he likes the word scriptor because it focuses on writing as a kind of an aesthetic act rather than a confessional one. So kind of think about that, you know, what does it mean for writing to be kind of concrete and scriptive, you know, using a pen, as opposed to kind of some sort of confessional outpouring that you could kind of do on a dictaphone and then give it to somebody to transcribe. That's not what Barthes is interested in. He says that the scriptor is, quote, born simultaneously with his text. For the scriptor, there is no other time than that of the utterance, and every text is eternally written here and now. Okay, language speaks, not the author. Language speaks, famous quote from Heidegger, language speaks. We mentioned Heidegger in a couple of lectures ago. But that's also something that, you know, Barthes trying to push, the idea that the text is kind of opening to you rather than the author. And, you know, I think a quick aside, we'll come back to that in a minute. Here is Barthes kind of talking about his obsession with fountain pens and ink. There's lots of quotes about ink that I could have given you. I'm a little bit obsessed with ink myself. Then I thought maybe you probably didn't want to hear all of these quotes about Barthes buying ink. But, you know, he's into them. He's into fountain pens. You know, I would say, he says in Le Monde in 1973, that I have an almost obsessive relation to writing instruments. I often switch from one pen to another just for the pleasure of it. I try out new ones. Besides, I have far too many pens. I don't know what to do with them. And yet, as soon as I see them, I start craving them. I cannot keep myself from buying them. I always return to fine ink pens. The essential thing is that they produce that soft, smooth writing I absolutely hold dear. That's important, you know. It's important that if you look at some of Barthes' sort of later books, they'll often kind of have a kind of photographs of his writing kind of inset into the book. He's sort of, you know, very nice kind of handwriting. And I mean, it's important, I think, that the essential thing, he says, is that they produce that soft, smooth writing. There's a kind of gentleness to the way in which he thinks language unfolds that is separate from what the author may have intended. So the author might be writing a kind of very violent kind of book. We might think of some of the sort of the violent scenes that you get in, say, Dickens novels about sort of, you know, strikes and the Industrial Revolution. But Barthes saying if you approach them in that way, you won't be able to understand them. You won't be able to kind of catch the nuances. So to sort of think about the kind of gentleness of the text and your approach to it. And this, I think, is what he calls the pleasure of the text. And he has a whole book called The Pleasure of the Text, although it's very short. And I want to talk to you about the pleasure of the text because it's so important to his death of the author idea, the way in which the author, get rid of the author, introduce in its place the pleasure of the text. So what Barthes arguing is that we, as readers, are freed into language by killing off the author. And enabling this pleasure of the text idea. So Barthes writes The Pleasure of the Text in 1975, so kind of 7 years after the death of the author, you know, as a sort of response to it. And he argues that the reading process of what we do when we kind of sit down and read a book, affects two different kinds of experience. Okay, two different experiences. One is called pleasure. The other is called jouissance. I think Dr. Geninati appropriately talked to you about jouissance. There's the word. He argues that we experience pleasure, the first term, pleasure when we read what he calls readily texts. By which he means that texts that are nice to go through, you can quickly go through them. He also calls readily texts horizontal texts. You know, you can get the, you know, I don't know, Heat. Heat's a readily text, right? You get it. You quickly flick through it. It's a magazine, you've got all those photos. You know, you go through it horizontally. You're not kind of flipping back and thinking, oh, I need to kind of refer back to that article on, you know, whatever, skinny jeans on page 3 to understand this now, this article about George Clooney or something. It's something that you go through quickly. You might kind of jump back and flip around, but you're not kind of trying to connect all the different parts of the text. Whereas jouissance, which is the kind of alternative to pleasure, is derived from what Barthes calls writerly texts, writerly, so the readerly and the writerly texts, those that require deep, close reading and prolonged thought, where we stick to the text and we read it with kind of real application. Now, obviously, jouissance and the kind of the writerly is better for Barthes. It's better. I mean, both are important, and I think it's helpful that Barthes also only thinks about the text in terms of pleasure and jouissance. It's not kind of, you know, displeasure and pleasure. He's not creating that kind of binary. He's saying we only really can get pleasure from a text. And if you're not getting pleasure from it, you know, don't read it, kind of, I think his argument is. And this writerly jouissance experience is better because it enables us to have a creative response to reading. And it transforms us into the writer, into what he calls the scriptor, if you like. And I think that's it's a key aspect of all of Barthes' writing, that idea, that as readers we become the writer. We stop being a kind of passive consumer of the text, and we become, for him, a sort of blissful scribe, you know, a kind of happy writer. We become the writer. And I think this process of becoming is really important to Barthes' thinking. And I think this is why, you know, I argued at the beginning that he's the most important philosopher, theorist of the 20th century. Because what he does is he always aims to speak differently. So he is challenging kind of conventions of his time. But he's doing it by retaining maybe values that we might call old-fashioned values of kind of enjoying books and reading them for pleasure, reading them because they're moving. I would argue, that Barthes a humanist. You know, other critics would, you know, there are other critics that argue that and other critics that would disagree with that, and you can decide. But, I mean, the reason I say he's a humanist is because everything that he writes about is the self. He always writes about the human in his books. All his books, as I say, are about himself in some way. He writes books in the forms of diaries, letters, autobiography. Lover's Discourse, for example, is just kind of like a dictionary of different kind of experiences related to love, some of which he relates to himself. His most recent book, which I, you know, encourage you to kind of read, it's called Morning Diary, which was just published. And it's literally a collection of little bits of paper that Barthes scribbled thoughts on after the death of his mother in 1977. So Barthes lived with his mother for nearly his entire life. So when she died, when she was in her 80s, it was sort of, you know, a huge kind of mourning experience for Barthes. And what he would do is just kind of take little scraps of paper. He would get A4 bits of paper and sort of rip them into four, leave them on his desk, and then write little fragments, again, in ink, right? So it's kind of like related to the kind of the pleasure of the literal text and writing it out. And, you know, here's a few of the kind of different things that he would write on these scraps of paper. You know, October the 27th, every morning around 6:30 in the darkness outside, the metallic racket of the garbage cans. She would say with relief, the night is finally over. She suffered during the night alone, a cruel business. November the 11th, horrible day, more and more wretched, crying. Last night, nightmare, maman lost. I'm overwhelmed, on the verge of tears. Poor Bart. My overcoat is so dreary that I know maman would never have tolerated the black or grey scarf I always wear with it. And I keep hearing her voice telling me to wear a little colour. For the first time then, I decide to wear a coloured scarf, scotch plaid. I mean, what do those things mean? What do those ideas mean? What does that mean as a text? In morning diary, that's just printed on one page. Looks like a poem, I think. And actually, later in the morning diary, Bart talks about the rhythm of morning and the routine of morning. And that's important, that routines become rhythms. That kind of habitual sense of life is what makes it kind of poetic and what makes it poetry, not in a kind of Christmas cracker kind of way where life is poetry, life is beautiful. It's not that kind of argument. It's that life makes sense when you kind of read it in these sort of short little snapshots in this slow way. So I think while we can call this narrative a kind of diary of suffering, it's also a very unpolished and rough, fragmented list of sometimes quite banal thoughts. I bought a scotch plaid scarf. Sometimes very moving thoughts. Like that. But it's also a collection of beginnings, because there's no narrative, right? So every kind of page demands that you close read it in a kind of writely way. It demands that you create it yourself. It is like a poem that seeks to map the routines of grieving. Bart says towards the end that he's caught abandonitis. He calls it abandonitis. A clinical term that he uses for feeling left and betrayed and lost. And I think that's an illness that we kind of catch ourselves when we're reading the diary. It's a process that takes a kind of a long time emotionally. We kind of feel abandoned in a way because we don't know what it's about and we can't really get into the meanings in a very quick way. But Bart doesn't want us to quick read anything. He wants us to enter into the jouissance of the text or the writeliness of everything we read and not sink into a kind of indulgent pleasure. So remember that this kind of jouissance word, this is not indulgence. It's not, I mean, often, it's associated with a kind of orgasmic bliss. It is kind of that. But, I mean, it's something more than that. It's not just about kind of having, a bit of fun or just reading the text, it kind of meaning something a lot to you and then you putting it down. It's about the text kind of having a sort of multiple rhythm of pleasure that returns to you all the time so that you're constantly thinking about it and absorbing it, if you like. But this is not to say that Bart is making the text into some sort of sacred object. It's not a kind of object that we need to kind of bow down and pray before, and I think that's really important. He says in his inaugural lecture, when he becomes a professor at the Sorbonne in Paris, the old values are no longer transmitted, no longer circulate, no longer impress. Literature is sacralized. Institutions are impotent to defend and impose it as the implicit model of the human. It is not, if you like, the literature is destroyed. Rather, it is no longer protected, so that this is the moment to deal with it. Okay, so we've lost the author. We do not want to kind of, raise authors up as kind of mini gods. So literature is what we knew it, Bart is saying when he writes this in the 70s, is over. It's over. But what are we going to do then? We're just going to change it and make it into cultural theory and kind of say that a novel's the same as a shopping list? Well, some critics will say that. They'll go back and they'll kind of look at things from the past and say, here's some, train timetables from the Victorian period, and aren't they interesting? Aren't they as interesting as a Browning poem? No, they're not. They're not, I would argue. They're totally different. Train timetable doesn't give you any pleasure, particularly a train timetable, because trains are always late. But I think that, this kind of sense of why do we enjoy a text? Why do we enjoy a text is something that Bart kind of constantly theorizes over and over again. Why do we find some texts out of date or out of place? Why do we not like them at a particular time? Why do we find them kind of problematic? Or why does other literature really speak to us and we kind of feel it in an immediate way? Those are the questions that Bart says are helpful to us as human beings, and the questions that he wants to pursue. So there he is. A finalist did that for me. I think it cheers him up a little bit because, he's been crying all the time anyway. So let's move on now to somebody very different, Foucault, where you've got kind of Bart looking kind of wistful and handsome. He's probably got some fountain pens in those boxes. Look at that stationery. I'm so jealous. We've got Foucault looking kind of... Foucault! This guy is different, right, to Bart. They're similar in some ways. They have a kind of shared heritage. They're often, as I said at the beginning, they're discussed together because they both worked in academia in France. They're both at the Sorbonne for a short time together. They both were kind of active politically in some of the kind of student demonstrations of the 1960s and 70s, which I'll talk about in a minute. They're both hugely central to the development of what we call critical theory. When you go into your second and third years, you'll be able to choose courses that are called literary and cultural theory and explorations in critical theory. Well, we wouldn't have those courses if it wasn't for Bart and Foucault. They wouldn't exist at all. So they're both very important, and I think that, you know, they're also both gay, and I think that's kind of an interesting sort of overlap too, but Bart in a kind of slightly more private way, I think. Not closeted, but just private, which I think accords with the theories that he's interested in. Foucault in a much more kind of like that, you know, way. He's a little bit more out there in all of his views, I think. And the essay that you're reading in your anthologies and which relates here is called What is an Author? What is an Author? Which appeared in 1969, okay? So 2 years after the death of the author. And the important thing is that, okay, you've got the death of the author, 1967, and then you've got Foucault writing What is an Author, 1969. There he is as well. That's why I had some more pictures. And then in 1968, in Paris, you have this huge kind of revolutionary event. And this is the thing that kind of separates, I think, Foucault's essay from Bart. So let me tell you about the event, and let me tell you about why it kind of affects their theories. Let's go back to that. So in May 1968, very famous date, there's lots of books called May 68, you know, poems called that. France experienced the largest general strike that had ever stopped the economy of an industrial country, ever. Okay, so ever. A strike that involved, I guess, well, 11 million workers for 2 weeks in a row. And what's significant for us is that the strike began as this intellectual protest involving a small number of basically poets, musicians, students. Okay, so a very small number who basically went and occupied an administrative building at Paris University and held a meeting in the council room, you know, a little bit like that kind of thing that happened at Warwick, I don't know when it was. A couple of weeks ago, everyone went in that room, didn't they, and ordered pizza. I guess that's kind of what they were doing, with, you know, without the pizza. And they, you know, there was a sort of sit-in to protest against the way in which the university were treating students and the way in which the government were treating workers. And they saw those two things as absolutely linked. They still are. You know, the students, I think, the students, you're the students, you know, when you're kind of having these protests against fees, you know, it would be a good idea to kind of get the trade unions involved in that, right? Because it's the same argument that the kind of, there's enough money, but that it goes to, you know, most of it goes to kind of a very small number of people, not to the masses. And that's the argument that the students are making in May 1968. So the university called the police, right? In the end, they haven't got the Warwick security guards to kind of go in and get them out. So they call the police. And as a result, students from the Sorbonne, which is the other university in Paris, so you've got Paris University and lots of Sorbonnes, another university in Paris, right? They then protested against the closure of the university, and then the police kind of move in and close the Sorbonne down. So the police have moved in and closed down two major universities, a bit like kind of closing Warwick down and closing Birmingham University down at the same time because of the protest. So as a result, you get this kind of demonstration, 20,000 students, teachers, supporters, all kind of march on the Sorbonne, which is still sealed off by the police at this point, who then, you know, have a conflict, you know, a very kind of violent conflict. The police throw tear gas into the crowds. Hundreds of students are arrested. I think Foucault is arrested. I don't think Barthes is. I think he's probably, I don't know, he's probably got a flask somewhere and sort of sitting at the back, you know, writing it down. But, you know, he's still there, right? He's still kind of political, but just in a different way. So all these people get arrested. The next day, though, instead of that just kind of being the end of it, which is usually what happens, you get a load of kind of general workers, basically all the workers in Paris, as I say, 11 million, high school students, teachers, anybody, all go and kind of get a stand at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris to demand that all the criminal charges are dropped against the students. Would that happen now? No, I don't think it would. Not now. It might in the future, but not now. I think that's important, you know, and the protest spirals out of control. It just keeps going and going. Now, you know, then you get this kind of half a million protesters then marching, you know, up to the government to talk to the president, Charles de Gaulle at the time. And I think by this point, the protest has become kind of more widely one against modern consumer and technical society. And while the government was not toppled, okay, it nearly was. So basically the kind of equivalent of that student protest that you had in the Arts Centre, not you, but people in the Arts Centre, you know, escalates into a position where the government is nearly kind of crushed and kind of, you know, totally fallen. And what really happens at that point is that France kind of has to move from being this very conservative, Roman Catholic, very patriotic kind of country into one that is much more focused on human rights and sexual liberation. And, you know, women don't get the vote in France for sort of, you know, a long time after women get the vote in Britain. I mean, there is a sense in which France moves from being this very conservative country into suddenly this amazingly radicalized community, partly, I think, because of people like Foucault and Barthes, the theorists that Katia talked to you about, Irigaray and Cixous, Derrida, Deleuze and Guattari. You don't need to know any of these names. You don't need to know how to spell them. You just need to know that there were lots and lots of really smart French philosophers that were kind of demanding that people pay attention to human rights and that the government listened to them. They didn't see them as a kind of separate group of people. They saw them as somebody that was, you know, a group that needed to be listened to. And in the aftermath of this event, May 1968, the French government then created a new experimental university. Wow, you know, well, wouldn't that be great if that could happen now? Called Paris 8, the number 8. And they appointed Foucault, the head of philosophy. You know, isn't that great? And while he was there, he wrote What is an Author? So it's a direct result of this kind of revolutionary moment in Paris. You know, Foucault writes this essay to return us to Barthes, and that's what's important. Foucault says, you know, let's not forget about what Barthes done. It's important. It's the kind of underscoring of this politics that we're now entering into. And Foucault, what Foucault's kind of main, I think, innovation is that he tells us that Barthes' argument is much more radical and political than we think it is, and that we should return to the question of authorship and ask precisely how the author role really does function in society. So he asks three basic questions. I mean, you've read the essay, right? But, you know, he asks these questions like, do catalogues classify books according to the name of their authors or not? You know, why, when you search for a book, do you look it up by the author? Well, we probably don't now, but when they were kind of in Paris, you know, the big Paris library there, everything was catalogued by author, not by the title, not by the date. Foucault says, why? Why is that? He says that books are only catalogued by the author in the 60s because of copyright laws around the author. And we still can't, you know, we're still bound by these copyright laws, right? That's why we can't photocopy lots of things for you because of copyright laws. And, you know, he gets into some of this in quite a lot of detail and thinks about why is it that the author lends capital to a book, right? So the author as a figure lends the book cultural capital, weight. It's by Shakespeare. It's by Dickens. It's by whoever, Jane Austen, you know. Or it's by, you know, I don't know, Frank Bloggs, you know. Who's he? There's no one called Frank Bloggs in here, I hope. Anyway, I mean, you know, if we were going to pick up, there isn't the same weight to that. Maybe there would be if Frank Bloggs became an amazing writer and wrote lots of things. But that kind of sense of the author kind of lending a weight to the text before we've even read it. You know, we read everything by Shakespeare. Of course we do. It's Shakespeare. That's why we read it. If it was stripped of Shakespeare's name and you just had to go and read a load of plays about a load of people that cross-dress and then kind of fall out and then get back together? Would you do it? I don't know. Would you? I mean, that's the question you have to think about. If you would had the name stripped from the text, would you read it? And that's what Foucault's asking us to think about. And he also says that the author is a label. It's like a label that's stuck on the book that limits our understanding of it, because we automatically think about it through, you know, whether the author is a man or a woman. And it also means that we've stopped recognizing those people as human beings. And Foucault says as soon as we start recognizing anyone as a human being, we enter into a process of dehumanization. And that's, of course, what Howl is about, too, the dangers of dehumanizing anyone. So it's not that Foucault is saying, ignore Dickens. He's saying, hey, you know, Charles Dickens is this interesting guy in his own right. He lived in a particular time. He had a wife, and, you know, he did these things. He wrote some books for his children, and, he's an interesting guy. But take that as a separate story from when you're reading Bleak House. Read Bleak House in a kind of writerly way. Create it for yourself. Don't impose the two things on one another. And Foucault's argument, as you'll know from reading the essay, is that we take the name of the author off the text, right, off everything, so the author is properly dead. And then we're freed to give meaning to the text. So here's his quote. We can easily imagine a culture where discourse would circulate without any need for an author. Discourse is whatever their status, form, or value, and regardless of our manner of handling them, would unfold in a pervasive anonymity. No longer the tiresome repetitions. Who is the real author? Have we proof of his authenticity and originality? What has he revealed of his most profound self in his language? New questions will be heard. What are the modes of existence of this discourse? Where does it come from? How is it circulated? Who controls it? What placements are determined for possible subjects? Who can fulfill these diverse functions of the subject? Behind all these questions, we would hear little more than the murmur of indifference. What matter who's speaking? What matter who's speaking? Does it matter? Well, no, says Foucault, because language speaks. Language speaks. Something that Barthes says, something that Heidegger says, and Foucault. And, it's a tremendously kind of important argument, because I think these questions, new questions will be heard. New, he says, in 1969. You know, like 40 years later, these are still new questions. Is this what we ask when we're reading a text? How is it circulated? Who controls it? Why is your curriculum the way it is? Why do you have to do certain things and not other things? You know, those questions are often not asked and not kind of interrogated. And, you know, they're important and humanizing, I think. So where does this get us with Howl? Well, I think that just like Barthes and Foucault, Ginsberg denounces the idea of the author being in control, where Barthes and Foucault censor the author god for controlling and dehumanizing the text. Ginsberg attacks capitalism and normative thinking for controlling the actions and lives of the vulnerable. And in part two of the poem, we're transported into this place called Rockland, which is Ginsberg's name for the psychiatric hospital, where he meets Carl Solomon, the person the poem's addressed to, and describes the schizophrenia that his friend is suffering, so immediately humanizing the text. And Ginsberg does this by turning away from his own authorial control, by totally removing his own authorship from the poem, and becoming one with Carl Solomon. So you can see it as a kind of direct intervention into these kind of debates. He says, I'm with you, Carl Solomon, in Rockland, where you will split the heavens of Long Island and resurrect your living human Jesus from the superhuman tomb. I'm with you in Rockland, where there are 25,000 mad comrades all singing the final stanzas of the Internationale. I'm with you in Rockland, where we hug and kiss the United States under our bedsheets, the United States that coughs all night and won't let us sleep. I'm with you in Rockland, where we wake up electrified out of the coma by our own souls' airplanes roaring over the roof. They've come to drop angelic bombs. You know, that kind of sense of togetherness, that's incredibly important for that howl. Because if you kind of think about, you know, what we're talking about in the first lecture, the idea of the poem being a kind of, you know, howl, I'm not going to do it. You know, that kind of, it's seen as a solitary thing, right? When you see kind of the howl of the Baskervilles or whatever, you know, that kind of idea of the solitary wolf howling. And Ginsberg says, no, you know, there's always someone there to be with if you just kind of recognize that togetherness. And that breaks down the authorial control of his poem, but also of all of our actions. It makes our actions communal. And of course, you know, there's this huge redemption in communality and shared meaning for Ginsberg. Not this kind of idea of the author, narrator, God dictating narrative. So if you get anything from these ideas of the death of the author, you will never again ask the question, you know, well, what does the author think? What did Blake say? What did Wordsworth think? You know, those questions have to be interrogated on their own terms, right? So they're not... it's not that I'm suggesting that you reject those questions. I'm suggesting that you see them all in a writerly way. You can go and read Wordsworth's letters, for example, and try and work out what you think he thought, and read those letters in a writerly way, and then go to his poems. But again, don't conflate them. So just to kind of finish off the last few minutes, I just want to, you know, finish off talking about Hal by thinking about this kind of redemption that Ginsberg offers us through the poem. This might embarrass Jill. I don't know where she is, but she's already laughing, so that's okay. She said to me in the first lecture, you know, don't say the word Jesus too many times in the rest of these lectures. You know, I'm kind of aware that I keep, you know, go on about religion all the time, but you know, this is a kind of Christian redemption that the poem is offering us in some ways. It's not a traditional model of Christian salvation. It doesn't return us to the idea of a controlling God, because it's a Christological salvation or redemption that Ginsberg's offering us, one in which kind of Jesus is seen as a kind of radical rebel, kind of motorcyclist dropping angelic bombs. And he says at the end of the poem, we all become reborn or resurrected into this new world, which casts off the ideologies of the old one. This is the way in which, for Ginsberg, I think you can get out of the old ideologies. You're in new ideologies, right? But at least you can get out of the old ones. He says, resurrect your living human Jesus. Your living human Jesus, the kind of Jesus aspect that's in you, the human bit in you. Urging our kind of his readers, I think, to awaken in the image of Jesus. And the figure, I'm just going to get the word in Jesus loads of times now, this is my last lecture, represents kind of humanness to Ginsberg, because he himself rejects ideology. He rejects Jewish law. He is like a kind of Jesus figure himself. He turns tables over. Jesus, that kind of radical figure who heals people on the Sabbath, that's who Ginsberg thinks he is. And that's the way in which he becomes this kind of truly holy figure. I think in your seminars you should work out how to scan this. Holy, 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 holy. The world is holy. The soul is holy. The skin is holy. The nose is holy. The tongue and the cock and hand and asshole, holy. Everything is holy. Everybody is holy. Everywhere is holy. Every day is in eternity. You know, there we are. That's, we've entered this state of holiness. We've accepted our humanness free of ideologies and capitalism and systems. It's a dream, in a way, for Ginsberg. And the thing is, up to you to kind of think about whether that can become a political reality or not. But I certainly would encourage you to read the whole poem as a kind of manifesto for how to initiate a kind of apocalypse or reawakening through poetry, through your own kind of creative human reading of poetry that kind of, I think, brings us back to Tchaikovsky and those questions of revolution in language. Now, just to finish off, I've got something very important to show you. And here's Bart again. But if you want to just, if you're over, you know, if you're just at home at Christmas and you want to show your parents what kind of thing you do, you can just show them this amazing slideshow, and hopefully you can just press that, and you've got a little Christmassy montage for Christmas. There's Foucault, he's very handsome. Look, almost human being in that picture. So there you go. So now you can, like, just kind of leave to this music and exit and have a very nice Christmas.